Welcome to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favourite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Jennifer Agnes, who is Managing Director at Synergia, which is a data strategy and analytics consultancy. You know, thanks so much for coming on the show. We've been dying to get you on for quite a long time, so we really do appreciate it, and I'm really excited for the conversation.
Hey, Ben, thanks for having me. I'm really glad to be here to talk about all things data with you.
Yeah, I'm really excited. We've got a big conversation ahead of us, I think, and we're definitely going to learn a lot from this conversation. So, yeah, let's get the ball rolling. So I guess to start with, before we get into that conversation, could you give us a bit of insight into your route into the world of technology and your role at Synergia?
Sure. So it's a really interesting question because in my language, I would never say I had a route into technology.
Right.
Because I start from risk management way back when I graduated from college, which the year I will not provide. You know, I went into banking and risk management, and that's really been the bulk of my career has been in risk management. But in order to do risk management, I had to have information that allowed me to make decisions in risk management, either writing up pitches and proposals for investment or reviewing them as I got, you know, more senior in my career, reviewing and making decisions. And one of the things that stood out was the inconsistency in how we analyzed and presented information about investment decisions.
Right.
That wasn't like me going to technology and saying, you know, we have to fix that. It was me in Excel trying to standardize calculations and present things consistently. So that is technology, I guess, but that's still our favorite tool, isn't it, Excel, from a technology perspective. So that was really my push into, I would say, data and technology, because that's where I started working very closely and almost, you know, inevitably without a technology partner, it doesn't work. So I've always worked hand in hand with technology teams and leaders, and I've learned so much from the technology teams over the years I've worked with them. And that's really how I got into, that's how I really got into this space of data and technology and ended up as a chief data officer, which we probably can talk about, whatever that is, in the future of this conversation. And so my role at Synergia is really kind of a culmination of all of the years I've spent in risk management, in business management, in team leadership and team creation and building and changing cultures and transformation and all of these things that I've done for a long time. And of course, working with the technology teams into a consultancy role, which after having met the CEO a couple of years ago and spent 2020 in COVID video chats with him, his name is Jason Foster, you may know, kind of felt right to move from, you know, the big corporate worlds I've been in into a very small and really powerful strategy consultancy,
yeah.
You know, data strategy consultancy. Yeah,
that's a really interesting story. And I know it's an opening question, but I do love asking it because everyone that I ask has such a different, you know, story around this. You know, some people have a really linear path into their position. Other people kind of fall into it. And, you know, it's just amazing to see the different stories that people have. But you mentioned you transferred from the corporate world into, you know, a new path and as a consultant after, you know, a long time in the corporate industry. So what was the catalyst for that move?
I think, I could say COVID, right? Yeah. COVID transformed pretty much everything around us in 2020. Yeah, I came back from a role as the first group chief data officer for Schneider Electric in early 2020, came back to the U.S. I was living in Paris, came back to the U.S. and really was looking for my next opportunity. And then COVID, mm-hmm. right? So we always have that sentence. It seems like everybody's January, February was good and then COVID. And so things sort of got very local. We all figured out how to reconnect with our friends over Zoom and reconnect with our colleagues and relationships over and build up, you know, a new way of communicating. You know, that's really where the idea was sort of born. I'll rewind just a tad bit. I had participated in 2018 with this group, with Synergure, in a what they call the CDO Hub, which is this awesome forum.
Yeah.
You know, Chatham House rules, but it's an awesome forum for chief data officers to get together, experienced strategic chief data officers to get together and really have closed door conversations about what's working well, what's not working well. Can we help each other building this community and paying it forward? I participated in one of their events back in March of 2018 and just thought the concept was healthy and really worth thinking about. Didn't have that when I was in Paris. And when I came back to the U.S., that's when I contacted, you know, then COVID. And then I started talking to Jason and Justin and these guys at Synergure. And it became something that I wanted to do here because I could to reconnect data experts, you know, experienced people to talk about this in a very safe and healthy and helpful environment. And so I kicked that off, actually, with their permission. So I sort of just wanted to take their access and some of their branding and just said, let me just try if we can build that up here. Next thing you know, by the time, you know, the summer rolled around, built up a little bit of plan, reconnected with some friends, some founders that I call them for the US version of it. And in September, we launched the first US-based CDO hub, which instead of it being just a New York City thing, because I'm based just outside New York City, it's actually a US-based thing because COVID, because we can. I don't have to get in, you know, we're not getting together in person right now. We want to do that in the future. But at that time, it's just like, okay, it's 6 o'clock or 5 o'clock everywhere here. Let's get on a call on Wednesdays, grab a drink, let's have a chat. What topics are we going to talk about? And since then, we've had 5 or 6, maybe 7 of them now. And everyone has talked about a particular topic that one of the members wants to drive or wants to facilitate. Mm-hmm. So I think of it more actually right now as a cooperative. It's like you get out what you put into it. So we're all sort of really making that. So we've grown it to about 20 members now. And we're, of course, looking to expand that membership with the right levels of experience and seniority and an attitude to try to help and pay it forward. Completely vendor free, by the way, right? Just in case anybody's listening, and I hope they are. But no vendors are invited, right? This is really a no egos, no vendors, I say, and we just like to get together to have a true and honest conversation once a month on every second Wednesday. So, and that's how it started. That's how I met these guys. And then I'm like, these guys are great. Their message is great, right? They are doing things for the right reasons, working with companies to create a positive impact. I mean, they've worked with, you know, nonprofits and dog and cat shelters and really things. I was like, this is great. Like, why wouldn't I try this out? And that's when Jason approached me and said, hey, what do you think about helping us launch something in the US? And I said, I'm up.
Amazing.
That's the storyline, really.
Yeah, I mean, that could be made into a Netflix film. That's a brilliant, that's really heartwarming as well.
Yeah. It's a really, really loving working with these guys. Yeah. And they're doing things that I like to do and I'm good at. And it's not limiting. It's pretty creative. And I like the creative side of things, always have. So.
Oh, amazing. Amazing.
Yeah.
You know, could you tell us a bit about Synergure and your approach to data strategy there? I mean, is it different to what you're used to? Or is it, you know, is it unique in any way?
I mean, I think what's unique about it, it's kind of like their USP, right? It's a great product. What we're helping people do is, you know, it's not a real term maybe yet, but data strategy as a service, right? We're thinking about helping companies understand that it's not just about their data, it's about their business strategy and how data actually creates value for their business strategy, right? So you can't ignore the data aspect anymore. It's tightly tied to the technology strategy, just like the technology strategy enables a business strategy, so does the data strategy. And, you know, it takes some time for companies and people to understand what and why and how it all fits together. But once you start to learn the components of it and you realize it's not just about, you know, creating definitions of the of a word so that everybody's speaking the same word, for example, for what is a customer, which is, by the way, a very important thing to do. Mm-hmm. But it's not just getting the definition of a customer versus a prospect versus an account, you know, all of the different words we have for that. It's really much more holistic. And it includes talking about and understanding what the vision is of the company, what value they're trying to create, and how data can then enable creating that value. But not just the data, it's the people and the culture. Mm-hmm. So how you behave and the skills that you hire, so the capabilities that you're hiring, how those then teams, not just the data team, but all the teams that have to work together, learn to work differently together. And these days, you know, it's much more focused on agile approaches to things, mindset, behaving differently. It's not a one shop, give it to a team, they go into the black hole, they come back with the answer. It's much more iterative and open and transparent, because we find value is created that way. Of course, you know, you can't do a lot of this without awesome data platforms that help move the data through quickly and kind of shrink the airtime between when the data is made and when somebody can consume it and do something useful with it. And then, of course, the data governance, data excellence aspect of it, which is back to basics of, do we know what we're talking about? Do we have some artifacts that are documenting what we're agreeing to? I mean, then packaging all that up into a practical, realistic roadmap over a period of 3, 6, 9, 12, 18, 24 months, you know, the further you, any model, further you go out, the less certainty it has. But, you know, really once you're working with the company, you start to help them understand the sequencing to get to their value as fast as possible. And that's very iterative with the companies you're working with. It's not something you write and you're done. It's something you work through, you get agreement on, and then you have to check it in every once in a while to make sure you're still making progress on that plan.
Yeah. And I suppose what strikes me is that, you know, the value of data differs with every business. So do you almost have to tailor your approach to every business individually?
Yes and no. So the concepts are the same. It's sort of these six pillars of a data strategy. This is Synerger's branded approach to it, right? Again, vision and value, people and culture, ways of working or operating model, getting your data technology and architecture platforms up and running, getting your data governance really good, and having a roadmap. So those are the six pieces. What's different is, and yes, it's different because you have to understand what's important to the company. And that's why, I mean, you can't go create the strategy and just go with the same approach to everything. You have to find the right people in the organization, the people that know the history, the people that know the future, the people that are willing to blend that together, and basically invest in learning about what's important and what the trajectory and the plan is, you know, of the CEO, of the board. What are you trying to become, especially in companies that aren't digital yet or know they need to go digital and don't really know how to do that? It's really tailored. But because of the expertise Synerger has, and bringing in, you know, experienced people like me and the other guys on the team, it's able to accelerate because we've seen so many different industries and so many different businesses. And I've come from, you know, I spent almost 20 years at GE Capital. I spent a couple of years in investment banking with Credit Suisse. I've spent some time, you know, I said Schneider Electric Energy Management. And what I've realized, and I'm sure everybody else who's done this before me, you know, data is pretty fungible. Okay, maybe you don't understand some of the nuances in the terms and the definitions, but the need for consistency, the need for a strong data culture, the need for the capabilities that you have to build, that is consistent across all of these companies, I think. And so you can get there faster if you've seen it all before. And these guys, you know, at Synerger, we have quite a list of successes with some really great companies over the past 4 years. The company's been around for about 4 years now, maybe a little over 4 years. So it's been, you know, there's a lot in the pocket there that helps accelerate the conversation because of the experience of this team. Mm.
And just on your team for a second there, do you have a very diverse team with lots of different backgrounds? Because I know that can, you know, different backgrounds and experiences, you know, with varying past careers, because I know that can massively help a team, especially in this kind of industry. I was just wondering about if that's the kind of dynamic that you guys have.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, I think, so I don't know everybody's history and where they came from, but I do know many of them started as, I think, you know, at Marks and Spencer's and in building up the full platform for analytics for Marks and Spencer's, you know, Tim Connold and Jason Foster were there, maybe James Lupton. But they all have broad backgrounds that brought them together, either in the past, which is, I find, always a nice model. If you can hook up with the people you really worked well with in the past and absolutely. Create something new, you've got your trusted core. And then you bring in all of these skills around it. And that's exactly what they do. They've got so many associates that they can call on that they've worked with and have delivered with over the past 4 years that it lets them ebb and flow with the volume, but also align to the right industry or the right topic, depending, you know, if it's strictly platform build skills and building up, you know, data platforms in Azure or other, they have this, this model that allows them to pull in the best of the best to deliver what the client is looking for. So I thought that was a great model too. I was like, wow, this is really useful to have so many levers and help with the experience of other industries or other capabilities within a company, because you've got so many levers to pull on it. It really does deliver things faster. You just have a network to ask. And it's kind of that community thing I was mentioning about the CDO hub. If you have a question, you have like 100 people to go, literally. You can get feedback, you know, you need a job description, you need help with this, what about that? And people respond pretty quickly because it's quite a community approach to it.
It's so important, I think, in almost any industry to kind of have that core community. And, you know, if there is one and you can get involved in it, then I 100%, you know, would say go for it. I mean, there's a similar one that we have in Manchester, which is the Manchester Tech. I think it's just a Slack group, but they meet up once a month and there's about 20 or 30 people, maybe 40 people that always meet up and they've become friends now. And, you know, there's a lot of relationships which have been built from that community. And that's a really healthy way to look at your industry, really.
Yeah. Yeah. And I couldn't agree more, Ben. I think that is a, people might know it and they're going to hear, oh yeah, of course that makes sense. But those connections and relationships you start to build, especially now, I think some of the walls are down because we're not in a room and we don't have on our fancy work clothes or something, right? Or makeup half the time, probably. I don't know. We're on a video chat and we're there all day and you're seeing people's dogs go by or kids come in or the sun is shining or it's dark, depending on the time of day you're on the call. And it kind of eliminates a lot of the layers, I think, we used to feel when you walked into a room and there's 20 people and you don't know anybody. You're like, ooh, this is awkward. Those three people really know each other and I don't know any, right? So it levels the playing field, this approach. I really wonder what it's going to be like when we start to meet people again in person. Maybe the ones we built long video relationships with, it'll be interesting, but ones that we never met, like, it might be a real pleasure to do that again, but it also might bring back all those hesitations when you walk in the room and you don't know anybody, right? Kind of thing. So I do think it's leveled the playing field a bit. Everybody's sitting at the same table, right?
Exactly. And I think you've got to remember that people are helpful. You know, people are generally quite nice, you know, people will accept you into their group. You know, if there's, you know, there's a community group, people will accept you in with open arms, you know, everyone wants to help each other. And, I mean, it sounds more difficult than it is, I think, to start building a community around your particular area. It can literally start from something as simple as, you know, if you've seen someone do something that you appreciate, even on LinkedIn, or if they've built a new project, literally just dropping them a message and giving them a sincere, you know, message, just saying, I really appreciate the work you've done. I have a lot of respect for it. And just opening up a conversation like that, even can that's yeah. where it can begin.
Yeah,
you know,
we should do that every day too, right? And you say it's like, oh, as good managers and leaders, we should always be telling people what they're doing great, making them feel good, and also helping them constructively
where
they can be doing better in a nice, safe environment. So I think that's those are two good points.
Yeah,
Ben. Yeah,
definitely. So on to data now. I mean, we need to get the true, you know, we're talking about the true value of data. So to open things up a bit, it's a little bit subjective, but in your opinion, what is good data?
What is good data? That's such a good question. Because we always say, you know, we used to talk about it in GE, what does good look like? And I'm doing air quotes on good. What does good look like? And good is really in the eye of the consumer, right? It's just like any other product. Like, you want to buy a good product. You want something that's good, but is what's good, good enough, good, you know, it's your definition of good for your particular use. You know, there's some fundamentals that you should be doing, which is good practice and good sustainable foundations that you should put in place to help you get good data. But getting good data is definitely in the eye of the beholder. So some of the processes that we put in place, you know, some of the foundations, you know, this pyramid I like to think about, where there's, you know, the core is making sure we have data management capabilities, making sure we have technology to support those data management capabilities. Above that, we might talk about having data excellence or data governance and making sure we know who owns the data and for what purpose they're using it. And then the better you get at those lower layers, the higher you can move into the pyramid of analytics and predictive analytics versus being reactive. And at the top of that pyramid, I think of it as the value. So you've sort of got this like six or seven layers to a pyramid to get to the value, but you never want to do it horizontally. Like, you can't build every layer. This week I'll build the bottom layer, next week I'll build the next layer. I mean, apart from it costing a lot of money, you're not getting the value, which is at the top of the pyramid, until later on in life. And I think a lot of times in the past, a long time ago, that was how we were thinking about it. We didn't have this product mentality. You know, in the last few years, really, the product mentality is what's key. And you can start to build the layers by creating products that make sense. So an example I would say of what good data is building a product that lets somebody consume a set of data elements, let's say data entities, things that tell them something together, like what customers, so pick a subset. In France, what customers bought which product this month? And that just alone, that gives you some information, you know, what's the best-selling product, second best-selling, you know, how much has my customer purchased over time? You might be able to click and look at a little bit more information, but you've created a product that gives somebody some insight. But I didn't build out my whole stack of my CRM, and I didn't build out my whole stack of my completely scalable data platform, right, to get to that. I'm just trying to start with a good use case because I'm trying to help somebody answer a question and get some insights so that they can ask the next question, which is really about, again, iterating and discovering what the information is going to tell you. And then you start to see what is good, right? It's like, oh, that's not, show it the first time. And everyone's like, that's wrong. They get very defensive. You've pulled the wrong data set. I mean, those conversations have gone on for years. But once you start showing that data set or those data sets regularly, people start realizing that it can be repaired or remediated or resolved in some way, shape, or form. Or you can decide to leave it. You can accept that the data is that way and it's not an important thing to fix. But combining that and showing that information starts to get people to care more. And then they start to help prioritize what should be the priorities for working on and getting information. And then you start to create what I termed, you know, reusable data assets, reusable data products. You shouldn't have every function in the company hoping they pick the right data set for that analysis. You should have a central store, I'm not talking technology. You should have a central place to go to pick up that data when you want it and know it's been quality checked. It's good enough for use. It should also tell you how other people are using it, why they're using it, so that you can see it. So you can make an educated guess. Is that the right data set for what I'm trying to do? Or do I need to ask for something different or better? And that's really the foundations of data governance or data excellence, as my friend Roberto Maranca has coined this term. Having a place to understand the decisions that we've made about data, and people can access that and learn from that information, is what this data catalog stuff is about, right? It's what the self-service is about. Not about just access to the data. It's about access to the information about the data and how others are using it to make decisions and choose what's good enough for their purpose. So nothing gets good without people, right? So, you know, that's another angle to it.
Wow, I've got a lot of questions that I could go off with this, Jennifer. One of them that strikes me, you know, I've spoken to a lot of data scientists in the past on this show, and one of the questions that comes up is, one of the trends amongst data scientists these days seems to be that data is more important than code. Now, would you agree with that, first of all?
Yes, and I would say, you know, again, showing my bias, I guess, here, and we can talk about that too eventually. I never thought code was more important than data, right? I always thought data was at least as important, if not more important, than the code. I mean, right? They have to go hand in hand.
Yeah.
So that question is an interesting one, because it's not how my head is working, right? That's like not how I'm thinking. I always thought the data and the information was very, very important. And the coding helped us see that data, not the other way around. So they were always together. I don't think it's fair to put one in front of the other. Maybe I'll just be neutral on that and say, I think they're both equally important. Maybe technically speaking, if we do, you know, and I really do want to say having our data well-structured and well-understood and well-defined and accessible, like, you can do so much if you have that as a foundation. You can code the hell out of it. But if you start coding on really bad data, who knows what you're going to get, apart from bias and everything else, right? So it's just, you know, I've always thought the fundamentals were important, which is making sure we knew what we were looking at, how it was designed, who's using it, how it's defined, and what its purpose is. So.
It's interesting because data is, you know, it's data, but there is a hugely human aspect involved in data and data analytics. And, you know, there's real people with real personalities and, you know, real subjective thoughts. And I mean, how do you look into data objectively and, you know, how do you avoid those unconscious biases?
I think that's one of the biggest questions out there. It's being, you know, I don't have the answer to that, but I know we have to be aware of it. And I think this has made us very, very aware the last 5 years of living through this, learning about it. And even recently during COVID and all the time we've had to read and write so many articles and books. I can't believe the number of books that have come out in 2020 about data and bias and AI and all this stuff. But you're so right. You know, everything we can code or build or design is definitely something that is going to break. Like, things always break, right? Mm-hmm. So we should be designing for a sustainable culture. And I don't mean, I'm not talking the world, I'm talking in a company. Like, why don't we design a great way of working and a great culture? Because we know things are going to break. They always do. They've been breaking for decades in our, you know, we coded something wrong. We plugged in something wrong. You know, we used to do the three finger salute to reboot our machines many years ago because something went wrong. But it's about the people, to your point, Ben, it's about the people and how we behave with each other and how we are actually much more focused on doing the right things with the information that we have, with whatever our role is in the company. I'm really hard pressed to find anybody in any company that I've worked in that doesn't have a role in data, even though they're not in the data team, kind of everybody touches data in some way, shape, or form. And I have a hard time finding somebody who doesn't really, who's part of the operations of an entity, of a company. You're either a creator or a producer of data, you might be a consumer of data, or you're an owner of data. There's not much more to it than that. Wherever you are in the data supply chain, you're doing something to it, even if you're sales, if you're HR, if you're in the data team, if you're in technology, if you're in the cafeteria, right? I mean, you're looking at information and you're doing something with it and making a decision with it regardless. So it's permeated our companies and our lives, as you know. So I'm hard pressed to find anybody who shouldn't care, and everybody should care. And that's the culture you try to get to, is whatever you're doing with data, you need to care, because the next person who's going to consume it needs it for something else. And you need to be aware of what that does in the data supply chain.
Do you think building that kind of data-centric environment in a business relies upon a lot of communication between, you know, teams and different teams to get the true value from that?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the only way it's going to work, I think, going forward. And I think what it does is start to find the right mindsets in your company who can drive that forward. I think what you want to do is, there's been a lot of people who care a lot about data for many, many years. But a lot of times they've been shushed or pushed to the side because, you know, there they go talking about data again. I think, you know, in the last few years, especially with the advent of this chief data officer role and the creation of data teams, you know, side by side with technology teams, it starts to give them the airtime that they needed, that they never had in the past. Mm-hmm. And you start to find this groundswell of support to help change the culture. And I think it's a top down, but I think it's a bottoms up culture shift. You kind of have to have that sandwich approach where the leadership is talking about, we're going to use data to make better decisions and grow our business and build new products. But you're going to bring in people with that statement that believe that and then want to operate that way. And they become your future leaders of the company. So it's like a generational thing. Like you need like a generation or two maybe to get there. But I think once you do, you know, the next generations of leadership should be very, very data centric and really start to manage and hire and retain, of course, retaining talent, right? If you go to a company and they say they're data centric and then they get there and they tell you, you know, you can't have access to data and no, you can't, you know, all sorts of limitations on what you can and can't do. And I mean that, you know, not in a negative sense, like in a regulatory sense, but I mean like, you know, they've just shut you off from things where you feel like you're not being able to add value because you can't have access to things, that you're not going to retain this talent today that is everywhere. Because of COVID, we can be everywhere. You can attract the best talent in the world right now, bring them in even on a gig basis or on a permanent basis. And they'll stay because it's fun, it's interesting, they want to be creative with data, right? If they get stymied or stifled, they're going to go to the next great show. And I don't blame them. So I think that's part of the culture as well, is like, you know, digital natives and getting people who are, no matter where they are in the organization, again, this leveling out of the bureaucracy, everybody's got some really good ideas. They, some have less experience, but they've got some good ideas, and it's worth creating that culture in a healthy way, right? Again, you know, you can go all out and do all the fancy stuff and have drinks on every day or something. I don't know what the fancy, you know, high-end tech companies are doing, but it's important to create this culture where people love to be there, love who they're working with and love what they're working on. And that really propels the energy and then the next gens that are coming in to help us get better and better. So that's what I find fun, actually, having done this for many, many years, as you know. That's part of my motivating thing, is just finding those secret pockets of people who love doing this and then getting together and brainstorming and building things together. That's the best part of it.
Yeah. And I think actually it's data, you know, if you mention the word data to someone who isn't working in the world of data, with no offense here, you know, you can imagine their eyes kind of glazing over and being like, oh, do you mean, oh, spreadsheets and things like that. And, you know, and people tend to think that data is only being used for, to help with your, you know, Amazon recommended, you know, shopping list or like recommended songs on Spotify and things like that. And it's like, yeah, that is one thing that it's being used for. But however, it can really impact everybody's life in a huge way, and especially in the business world as well. So I'm starting to see it more, you know, when I speak to people at work in data, that they're really starting to see the benefit and see how valuable data is across the whole business now. And I think in recent years, they're starting to take it far more seriously. Is that something that you found as well?
Yeah, for sure. And I'm very glad, because that's kind of what I've been pushing for so long. But I remember those days walking into my manager's office, and I knew what they pull out their BlackBerry and go, she's here to talk to me about data again, right? Because I remember those glossed over days. I'm like, I got to find a better way to tell this story, Jen. Like, it's about time to find a better way to tell this story. So I still work on that story, right? That's a hard thing to get people to understand, which is why it's so important. Again, back to the Synerger model, which is, I'm not talking about data for fun or for data's sake, although I think it's fun. I'm not talking about it for data's sake. I'm talking about it because it's going to help you get your objectives and what you told the board you were going to do, this way of looking at data and creating a culture that is data centric. It's actually going to, you know, accelerate your growth, because we can do these three things to help you accelerate your growth: get you information, build new products, so many things. So that's part of the storytelling that has to really happen. You know, I think in the old days when we started this, you know, it was data governance and regulatory and defensive, and I come from financial services. So we had to do that, and trying to rationalize why you had to do it was a really hard thing, because the regulators were telling you had to do lineage and define and make sure you knew how you're calculating your capital ratios. Super hard from a legacy situation to go through and do the lineage to all the different systems and how it aggregates, you know, this stuff that we did with, you know, BCBS 239 back in regulatory when I was working in banking. That defensive position is hard to get any positive vibes out of, but you got to do it, right? On the other hand, in a lot of these companies that are really just trying to grow, there's a lot more creativity and willingness to go offense on this, right? And play offense, which is, how am I going to do the right thing to create value, not just to satisfy a regulator, right? So I think the depending on the industry you're in, you know, you have a little bit more of an opportunity to find a way to tell the story. That's a more catchy way.
Yeah. Yeah. I've heard a lot of people say a similar thing as well to you. Telling a similar story is an interesting one. Now we could literally talk about data, Jennifer, all day here. We really could. But I kind of want to know a little bit more about yourself. And, you know, if we could have a look at your career reflection, maybe, if you're ready to look back on that. And I was just wondering, is there anything you wish you were told when you started out in your career that you've had to go on and learn the hard way?
I've learned so many things the hard way. I would say, Ben, and I don't want to say it's the hard way, because I think these are, okay, sometimes they end up being hard at the time, but looking back, nothing feels super hard. It feels like now with experience, it's just, yeah, that was right. I should have known better, right? And I did learn from that. I think, you know, you don't know what you're, and I'll give you the example after this. I'm going to give you the theory here. Mm-hmm. I'm somebody who kind of just says yes. I'm like, that looks like fun. I'm going to do that. Yep. I'm going to try that. I like to create things. But I've been in financial services, so you know, it's still a very structured environment. But if an opportunity came up, I was like, oh, that sounds like fun. Let's try that. So, Or if I wasn't having fun, I'd create something that was, I thought, going to be more fun. One of the decisions I made was to, one of the decisions I made in retrospect at the time, I was like, God, I should never have done that. And even today, I think, how on earth did I say yes to that?
Okay, well, I'm very intrigued about what this is, Jennifer. I'm on the edge of my seat right here.
Oh, all right. Well, I'll give you the scoop. When I first started out, I said yes to this awesome opportunity to go to France and work as an auditor on a real estate portfolio in a bank. So I was in real estate when I graduated from university. I had a real estate major and a French minor. And so I went to France and took this sort of audit role. I was going over to look at the books of the real estate investments at the time. And they were little marchands de biens, they called them, little investments at the time that I had done. They're big dollars or big French francs. It'll tell you how long ago this was. A big French francs investments. Going there, I just thought, wow, I'm going to go to France. This is cool, right? I'm in my mid-20s. This is awesome. Like Emily in Paris life, right? Type of thing. Which it was, by the way. It was very awesome to do that for my own education. But at the same time, I just thought everything was going to be smooth sailing. But little did I know, even having studied French for many years, that, you know, I could barely get around. Barely buy things. I couldn't go to the post office. I couldn't get my dry cleaning. Okay, we had no phones. We had no Google Translate. We had none of that stuff. So this is a long time ago. So it was on my own. I had no cell phone. Like I didn't call home. It's like what on earth possessed me to say yes to something like that? Now that I know what we have today, how on earth did I get on a plane by myself, go do that at a company that was doing, you know, real estate in French? And I had to figure out, you know, the terms, the language, the risk, the way to get the mortgage process, the releasing of mortgage processes, the tenants, the leases. I mean, I had no idea then, but I was just like, this sounds like fun. I've done real estate in New York. Let's go do that. It's like, boom, holy cow. Eyes wide open, Jen. I'm sure if I asked my mom, she'd be like, I told you. But in fact, that's probably not true. She would say, that was the best thing you could have ever done, right? But, you know, and then language-wise, and I speak much better French than I did a long time ago. Language-wise, you know, I didn't know the terms. I didn't know basic business terms even, right? I mean, it just wasn't at your fingertips. So those are the kind of things I learned the hard way, especially, and just as a little nuance, a long time ago, coming in as the American woman, you know, all of a sudden overseeing some senior people doing investments in real estate, you know, people didn't like that. Mm. Right. So there was a lot of, you know, innuendo or a lot of just not great environmental situations that, you know, that I was in. And I wouldn't trade it for the world then. I wouldn't trade it for the world looking back on it.
Yeah.
But I do remember some days that were pretty brutal.
Yeah.
Pretty brutal. But right now I love every minute of it. And it's one of the things that helped shape my ways of dealing with people cross culture. And I don't mean, I'm not talking data culture now, I'm talking cross culturally. How do you bridge different cultures? And, you know, and I think that was a huge driver of my mindset about being aware and being open to other cultures and how we're perceived as Americans and vice versa. I'm like super aware of that ever since that journey of mine, which I wouldn't trade for the world. So hard lessons, yes, but good lessons is say yes and try it, because usually it's for the better.
Absolutely. I completely agree. And I had a question, which was, you know, obviously you've learned the hard way, but you already answered the question, which was, but you wouldn't change it. You wouldn't change them. I mean, I think that's a common thread throughout a lot of people that I've asked that question is, but you go through those experiences and you always come out the other side, and you come out the other side better than if, say, someone had told you, you know, just before you went to France, if someone just, you know, took your ticket, your plane ticket, and just ripped it up and said, don't go. Because you wouldn't have experienced it. And, you know, I think life and experiences, it's all about that. It's all about, you know, the good and the bad things that happen to you. And that really creates who you are as a person.
Totally. And those experiences, just one more, like, as I'm describing it to you, I can, and it was a long time ago, I can literally see it. Like, I have the images of this going on, and like, it brings back, it was so impactful in my development, I would say, over the years. Like, I can relive that, and almost feel sort of some of the stress of it at the time, just by describing it. I see the people's faces. I mean, it's really something that was quite influential, but awesome. So I'm really happy I did it. And anybody who's listening, take those opportunities and say yes and try it. And if you don't like it, now you have a cell phone. You can call home. Back then, I couldn't get home or call home or video chat anybody at the time. So I would just go back to my hotel and cry or something.
Oh, no. Oh, my God. This is a lot to take in, Jennifer. It really is.
Sorry, Ben. I didn't mean to go that rogue on you on this chat.
It's fine. Oh yeah, I was going to say, these experiences, even if they're negative experiences, are incredibly powerful to someone's life. I mean, that's why I think if someone has an opportunity to try something and they're kind of 50-50, I think go for it anyway, because if it's horrendous and it's hell on earth and it's the worst thing ever, you know, within reason, then it's probably going to help you out down the line, you know, it's going to build you as a person. And then if it's great, then that's brilliant too. So it's almost like looking at it from a completely different angle, really. We might be getting a little bit philosophical here, but
I think we might be.
I'm quite a philosophical person.
But it's hard to see when you're young too, right, Ben? Like, you're like 25 or 23 or whatever.
That's very, very kind, Jennifer.
It's hard to see when you're young. No, I generally speaking, right? If you're just getting out of college and someone says no to you, you're like, who are you to say no to me? Yeah. I'm invincible, remember? Like, invincible. So you get a little bit older, then you're less invincible.
Yeah. I love these. I love this kind of conversation, though. But
cool. Good. Great.
Amazing words of advice there. Really. I've honestly enjoyed this conversation so much. We've definitely put the data world to right, and beyond that even. So thanks so much for taking the time to sit and chat with me on this Friday afternoon, and, you know, give such great and open and honest and, you know, thought provoking answers. I've really, really enjoyed it.
Yeah, me too, Ben. I really appreciate you taking your Friday afternoon. It's close to closeout over there. Here it's nice and sunny in Connecticut, so I've got the rest of my day ahead of me. But I really enjoyed talking to you. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you, Jennifer. It's a pleasure. Thanks for listening to Ben Shorey's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.